From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Dallas leads an International Day of Remembrance, 50 years after the assassination of President Kennedy.
A new era dawned and another waned a half a century ago when hope and hatred collided right here in Dallas.
We're in Geneva for day three of talks over Iran's nuclear aspirations, and we go to New York where we investigate the violent street trend of the so-called knockout game. And also today, we hear about one woman's long fight for justice for the Scottsboro boys.
They never knew how important they were until after death. That's why I want to recognize them and keep their names out there so that people would never forget injustice.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United States has been marking the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. President Obama called for flags over government buildings, as well as private homes and businesses, to be flown at half-mast. The proclamation from the White House speaks of Kennedy's broad vision and soaring but sober idealism. Christopher Arterton, a professor of political management at George Washington University, says the killing back in 1963 changed the country.
All of the promise of, quote, Camelot and bringing the best and brightest to Washington, all of that seemed to disappear in an instant, and tragically so, taken away by a bullet.
The U.S. and Afghanistan are clashing over the timetable for a new security agreement. The deal will govern the presence of American forces in Afghanistan after the combat mission formally ends next year. President Obama says it must be signed by the end of this year, but President Karzai wants to wait until after elections next spring. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
Speaking before a meeting of more than 2,000 Afghan elders, President Karzai urged them to support the deal. It would allow thousands of US troops to stay on in the country to train and assist Afghan forces. But as the elders debated the pact, President Karzai announced it would not be signed until after a new leader was elected next spring. But the U.S. said it was neither practical nor possible to delay the signing.
Warring militias have recruited up to 6,000 child soldiers in the Central African Republic. That's according to UNICEF, which has issued a dire warning over the deteriorating humanitarian crisis there. The UN Children's Agency has doubled its previous estimate of the number of children press-ganged into armed groups, while the European Union is sounding the alarm over the spiraling situation. And the U.S. is coming under mounting pressure to act. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Amid dire warnings of anarchy, widespread violence, and potential genocide, the White House faces intense criticism for failing to take a clear position on developments in the Central African Republic. Now, new figures from the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, that some 6,000 children, many as young as 8, are said to be enlisted by the country's warring factions, double the previous estimate from March. The crisis in the Central African Republic began last year with a coup by Seleka, a rebel coalition which ousted the longtime president François Bozize in March. The leader of Seleka, Michel Djotodia, named himself president but agreed to hold elections next year. Armed militias and ethnic and religious violence has prompted warnings the country is in a pre-genocide phase, and calls are growing for the international community to do more to prevent a deepening humanitarian crisis.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, has been given special powers by the country's parliament that will allow him to rule by decree. Venezuela's National Assembly voted to allow Maduro to pass laws without consulting them for the next 12 months. Our Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
For the next year, Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro will be legally allowed to pass laws without having to go through parliament for their approval. The measure had been debated for 3 months before this week's vote. The result was a victory for the Maduro administration, who won in April's presidential elections by a very narrow margin. President Maduro argues that he needs the special powers in order to fight corruption, battle inflation, deal with food shortages, and help put the country back on the road for economic growth and stability. But Venezuela's opposition leader, Enrique Capriles, warned about the dangers of giving Nicolás Maduro absolute power and urged Venezuela's to join him in protesting the law.
And the U.S. is urging North Korea to free an 85-year-old American citizen after reports that he's been detained in the country. Merrill Newman, a Korean War veteran from California, was taken off a plane by uniformed officers at the end of a guided tour last month, according to his son. Lorna Shattuck has more.
Officials in the U.S. haven't specifically confirmed the case of Merrill Newman, but they have called on North Korea to resolve the issue, and State Department sources say they've been working on it for some time. The travel warning for U.S. citizens planning to visit North Korea has since been raised. Mr. Newman from Palo Alto in California is reported to have been removed from an Air Koryo flight bound for China on the 26th of October. The reason for the arrest is unknown, but Mr. Newman's son believes it may have something to do with the discussion of his father's military service during the Korean War that took place the day before his detention.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
And I hope that President Kennedy would be pleased with our humble efforts towards fulfilling our country's highest calling, that of providing the opportunity for all citizens to exercise those inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That was Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings speaking in a damp Dealey Plaza as the city and the world remembered the life of President John F. Kennedy. It's exactly 50 years since his assassination, an event that stunned Americans and the international community. And as Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington, the killing of America's 35th president on that fateful day changed the country and created an icon.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
It was with those words exactly half a century ago that CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite told America that President John F. Kennedy had been assassinated.
Several thousand enthusiastic Texans are on hand to give the President and Mrs. Kennedy a warm welcome.
A local radio reporter earlier that day had described how the young leader and his wife Jacqueline had arrived in Dallas to cheering crowds. With elections coming the next year, the pre-planned journey from the airport into the city by motorcade was designed to maximise the first couple's exposure to the enthusiastic crowds who thronged the route, with Mr. Kennedy later planning to deliver a speech in a state seen as key to his ambition of winning a second term. But as the motorcade passed the school book depository, shots rang out.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound.
The motorcade sped away. Bystanders took cover. The security team reacted, but it was all too late. Journalists and listeners alike struggled to comprehend the news.
The President of the United States is dead. President Kennedy has been assassinated. It's official now. The President is dead.
The loss of such a charismatic leader left young and old, black and white, weeping openly in the streets.
A friend of mine came bursting out of the door, yelling, "The President's been shot. The President's been shot."
That's Christopher Arterton, a professor of political management at George Washington University, who was a student at the time. He says the killing fixed Kennedy forever in the nation's memory.
We didn't see him grow old. Having him cut down in the prime of life really has made him into much more of an iconic figure than he would have been if he'd lived. All of the promise of, quote, Camelot and bringing the best and brightest to Washington, all of that seemed to disappear in an instant.
That lost promise seems to be part of what still fascinates Americans about JFK to this day. The wondering about what might have been had he lived out another term in office. It's such what-ifs that motivated thousands of people to visit Kennedy's grave at Arlington Cemetery this Friday, to queue up at his presidential library in Boston, and to fill Dealey Plaza in Dallas, where music and readings of the president's speeches eventually gave way to a moment of silence. It may be 50 years on, but it seems by marking this anniversary, many Americans are still mourning the death not only of JFK, but the dream he represented. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
Well, after a day of remembrance for John F. Kennedy, with crowds thronging to memorial sites, FSN's Priscilla Huff spoke to presidential historian Robert Dalek, and she began by asking him why JFK still fascinates us so much.
Of course, he was assassinated, But that's not sufficient to explain his appeal. Part of the Kennedy mystique is that he was the first television president, and he's captured on tapes. We have him in our minds. He's frozen there at the age of 46. Nobody can quite imagine that if he were alive today, he'd be 96 years old. And of course, he was glamorous, handsome, attractive, witty, charming, intelligent. And the Kennedys en masse have a kind of, they're America's royal family, not the Roosevelts, not the Bushes, but the Kennedys.
The anniversary is often cited as the moment TV came into its own.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Kennedy knew television was his ally because he then had, beginning in the start of his administration, he had live televised press conferences. There were some people who said, don't do it, you could make blunders. But he knew how well he had done on television against Nixon, and that TV was his ally. So when he was killed, you see, it became a kind of television event, not just because so many people watched on television, but the funeral. And Jackie Kennedy and the children, her stoicism, one might say, in the face of this tragedy, and the ceremonial that surrounded the church proceedings in his funeral, it captured the public's imagination.
His brief time in office is often called Camelot. Do you think that people romanticize that 2.5 years?
They do romanticize. The Camelot image is, of course, a kind of a myth. But there were significant accomplishments. First of all, being the first Catholic to have been elected, he broke the hold white Protestant males on the office. And one can see a direct line to Barack Obama, the first African-American to gain the office. And it won't be long, we'll see a woman as president. Also, he put the Civil Rights Bill before the Congress. He didn't enact it. He died. But Lyndon Johnson did, and that's one of the greatest pieces of social legislation in the country's history.
Robert Dulick speaking with FSN's Priscilla Huff.
This is FSN Reports. The third day of talks over limiting Iran's nuclear program hit some new obstacles in Geneva. Iranian diplomats want Iran's right to enrich uranium recognised, a move that's not playing well with the six world powers. This follows John Kerry's remarks that now was the best chance for a decade to resolve the nuclear issue. The West has long suspected Tehran of trying to develop a nuclear weapon, something Iran has consistently denied. Earlier, I spoke to Al Monitor reporter Laura Rosen, who's covering events in Geneva.
Last night, the Iranians broke off the meetings at about 9 p.m. With the understanding that some of the P5+1 delegations were calling back to their capitals overnight and getting further instructions, and they might be able to get a little more going in their direction today. And that appears to be happening. The Iranians are giving more optimistic signals. They're suggesting that the language in the text in the draft accord they're working on here, that they've resolved an issue on enrichment today, that they've come to some sort of mutually agreed formula for how they can, have enrichment in the future.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has just arrived in Geneva to join these talks. Does that suggest that they're moving in a more positive direction, the deal could be ever closer? And could we see John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, also fly into Geneva? He certainly suggested he was willing to do that earlier in the week.
The Russian foreign minister, it seems that he is coming both to work on the Iran issue and then to discuss the Syria issue in a couple days. And their reporters at the State Department have been told to have their bags packed to possibly fly with Kerry to Geneva, although it has not officially been announced if he's coming.
If a deal isn't nailed down in this round of talks, do you think we're going to see the momentum and that newfound optimism sort of fall away?
Yes, it will be hard if they have a second meeting where at this high level where they can't get basically close the deal. And my sense is all the anxiety and the snags that were reported on yesterday, there's a very strong effort to resolve those and to keep talking at this meeting until they can sign something.
Al Monitor's Laura Rosen in Geneva. Now, unless Congress acts in the next few weeks left before their holiday recess, the federal benefits for nearly 1.5 million long-term unemployed will expire. This week, House and Senate Democrats introduced emergency legislation to extend the benefits through 2014, calling them a lifeline for struggling families and the local businesses where those benefits are spent. But with little support from Republicans amidst tense negotiations over a national budget and a farm bill, the fate of the support program remains uncertain. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein reports.
There are currently more than 4 million people who have been out of work for 27 weeks or more and depend on federal assistance. But more than half of them could lose their benefits in the coming months if Congress fails to renew the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Act. Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow, who sits on the committee currently negotiating a budget for next year, said shame on congressional leaders if they refuse to include funding for the long-term unemployed in that budget.
We've just gone through the worst situation, the greatest recession since the Great Depression. A lot of folks think it's over. Everybody's back on their feet. And the truth is we still have too many families that are still struggling.
President George W. Bush signed the program into law in 2008, just as the nation was entering the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. The program, which has been reauthorized 11 times since then, gives benefits to out-of-work Americans who have already exhausted their state benefits, which generally last 26 weeks. California Democrat Barbara Lee called letting the unemployment funding expire morally wrong and economically stupid.
People who are going to possibly, if we don't do something, lose their unemployment compensation at the end of the year also received a cut in SNAP benefits as of November 1st, an automatic cut. What in the world are we doing in this country? This is un-American.
So far, no Republicans have co-sponsored the bill recently introduced by Lee and others to extend the benefits through 2014. And those Republicans who have voiced support for the program want to offset its cost, estimated at $25 billion, by making cuts elsewhere. At a press conference this week, New York Democrat Charlie Rangel pleaded with them not to do so.
We've gone far enough in beating up on the lesser of our brothers and sisters. When people work hard and have the dignity of having a job and lose it through no fault of their own, if it's anyone's fault, it's mistakes that government has made. These people have paid into a system that even if the economy has let them down, our country should not let them down.
According to the Economic Policy Institute, cutting off these benefits could cost the economy nearly $38 billion in economic activity and more than 30,000 jobs next year alone, as people would not be spending that money on goods and services. The funding is currently set to expire on December 28th. In Washington, I'm Alice Ulstein.
A disturbing and violent game seems to have made its way to the New York borough of Brooklyn in recent weeks. The game is called Knockout, and the neighborhood of Crown Heights has seen a rise in the number of incidents of Orthodox Jews being deliberately targeted and attacked. Nick Harper reports from New York.
The idea behind the game of Knockout is to hit an unsuspecting person in a public place, sometimes filming the attack and posting it on the internet. In some cases, the goal is to knock the victim out with one punch. The Crown Heights neighborhood of Brooklyn has a predominantly African-American population, but there's also a sizable Hasidic Jewish minority. In recent weeks, there have been at least 8 attacks, all of them appearing to be racially motivated. Letitia James takes over as New York City's public advocate in the new year, and she's worried about the rise in numbers and the clear racial divide of attackers and victims.
They've all been black men, black young teens, and the victims have all in Crown Heights and in Midwood been members of the Orthodox community. And so it seems that they're singling out individuals, and so there appears to be a biased nature to all of this.
Crown Heights has a history of racial tension between its African American and Jewish residents. The notorious Crown Heights riots of 1991 lasted for 3 days, leaving one person dead and many others injured. However, since then, the situation has improved dramatically. Rabbi Yaakov Bierman of the Brooklyn-based Jewish Future Alliance has seen attitudes change over time.
Today, the community as a whole, we get along with our Caribbean American, African American neighbors. We have a great relationship. We work together. And I believe that these attacks are isolated incidents of anti-Semitism.
Bierman is now calling for a greater police presence in the area and wants to try and raise awareness of the situation.
I believe once there's an arrest and once some of these kids realize there's going to be severe consequences for what they're doing, it's going to stop.
Letitia James says there are laws specifically in place to deal with these types of racially motivated attacks.
This is being perceived as a hate crime in the city of New York, and how under our criminal statutes, hate crimes are taken very serious, and there's heightened awareness and a heightened prosecution and a heightened sentence for these types of crimes.
There appears to be no clear motive behind the unprovoked random attacks, and community leaders worry it may come down to teenage boredom or simply a desire for acceptance and respect amongst peers.
We need to talk about these issues in our schools, in our churches, on our blocks, on basketball courts, barbershops, wherever individuals are gathered.
In Crown Heights so far, thank God, the injuries have been minor. And the kids who are doing these attacks are not hardcore gangbanger criminals. So I believe if we stop them now and we put an end to it, you know, some of these kids could be real leaders in the future. They just have to be taught.
The hope now is that awareness of these incidents may in fact help to bring the two communities closer together as they try to combat the incidents with a united front, rather than driving them further apart, as James explains.
It's really critically important that people understand that this only represents a small percentage of individuals in the black community, and individuals obviously who have no sense of humanity and who have no sense of the shared history with the black community and the Jewish community.
So far, the attacks in Crown Heights have not been on the level of violence seen in other parts of the country. Knockout games in other cities have hospitalised victims, and in one case ended with a victim being killed. However, advocates in both the African American and Jewish communities hope these incidents will stop before they get any worse. Nick Harper, New York.
After 3 years of research, planning and testing, a youth organisation in London has won planning permission to create two small communities of converted shipping containers. Originally from China, the containers have undergone a high-tech transformation to ensuite studio apartments. They were created to solve an acute problem in London, the lack of affordable homes. Our reporter Natalie Powell went to take a look around.
From the outside, they don't look like much. In fact, what they look like are painted shipping containers stacked on top of one another. But inside, it's a different story. They are the product of 3 years of research and testing. A simple but high-tech home for one person, comprising ensuite studio apartment facilities, small but perfectly formed. The transformed cargo containers, called MyPads, are the brainchild of one man, Christopher Payne, the CEO of London's Walthamstow Forests YMCA youth charity.
The price of accommodation in this part of London means that you can't afford it if you're on minimum wage. And so it was trying to find something that would bridge that gap, that would be a stepping stone between living in a hostel and getting into the private rented sector.
550 young people come through the doors of the YMCA in the Walthamstow area of London each year, needing help, support and accommodation. But once on their feet, their experience in the private rental sector can be a shock. Private rents in the capital are soaring, up almost 5% year on year, and now stand at an average of £1,100, the equivalent to $1,800 per month. The MyPads have been designed with low energy costs and will be rented out at £70 a week, around $100. The total cost for one of these studio apartments is £20,000, and these shipping container homes could last for over 10 years. Figures the YMCA says is cheaper than 1 year of supporting someone on housing benefits. Young people like Louise Stevenson, who are being helped by the YMCA, are impressed with the MyPads.
I think it's amazing. Got everything you need in here. It's warm, it's comfortable, but everything's new. Got a TV, you've got your cooker, you've got a fridge, you've got your shower room. Got everything, really. So I think they're amazing. From the outside, yeah, you might think, oh yeah, it's a shipping container. But inside, you just feel like you're in a nice hotel room or a nice self-contained living quarters.
But not everyone has been so welcoming. The council, which approved plans for two developments, remains cautious. It says it will watch the progress of the MyPad developments with interest, but the council does not see the use of shipping crates as the answer for the 21,000 people needing accommodation in this London borough alone. And Christopher Payne, the CEO of Walthamstow Forests YMCA, agrees with them to some extent.
I fully accept that shipping containers like these are not the long-term solution, but we face a crisis at the moment that's on a parallel with after the Second World War.
But it is a solution that's prompting a great deal of interest, not only from London's other boroughs, which face similar housing needs, but also internationally, raising the prospect that this experiment could one day be seen further afield. Natalie Powell, London.
And this is a song we've got for boys. Booty Alabama, any better without the landlord to get you gonna jump and shout.
The song The Scottsboro Boys, recorded by Lead Belly in 1938, protesting at the convictions of nine black teenagers falsely accused of rape in 1931. Five of those convictions have since been overturned and a sixth has been pardoned. But only now, 82 years later, have the final three received posthumous pardons. The teenagers, found guilty by all-white juries and who became known as the Scottsboro Boys, helped to spark the civil rights movement. Founder of the Scottsboro Boys Museum, Sheila Washington, led the campaign to get them pardoned. FSN's Kate Fisher asked her how she feels now she's finally achieved justice.
It's a happy and sad moment. And I felt sad because no family was there. We couldn't locate or find anybody. So time has, you know, they've been lost in time, per se. And I'm glad that I was able to do this for them. I come home today in my hometown, picked up the paper, nothing. I've rejoiced outside of this area, but this town still don't want to be known as the Scottsboro Boys case where they done this injustice 82 years ago.
This is the year that we're celebrating 50 years since Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. How significant are the Scottsboro Boys in the civil rights movement, in especially in this landmark year that they're also pardoned?
Thank you so much for asking that question. 50 years in the civil rights movement. Well, this case is 82 years old. So they skip this case and go to the Rosa Parks case as the movement. I celebrate Rosa Parks Black History Month every year. But what she did is nothing compared to what the Scottsboro Boys had to go through in their lifetime. They never knew how important they were until after death. That's why I want to recognize them and keep their names out there so that people would never forget the injustice that they went through and how they had to fight their whole entire life. So I do celebrate all that Dr. King has done, but it's still more that needs to be done.
Do you think the fact that they've finally been pardoned, can you see the positivity in that? And do you think it is some kind of step forward?
It is a step forward because this is the first time. I mean, being the first of anything is great. And the Scottsboro Boys Act, which became law in April, has allowed this to happen. So I do rejoice in that other families may find peace and trying to get a family member pardoned.
Sheila Washington speaking to FSN's Kate Fisher. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can always tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Coming up on Monday, we'll take you on a trip around London's Silicon Roundabout. That's Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.